something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today I wanted to start off with a kind of thought experiment that I think we've actually used on the show before, but we'll use it again because I think it is useful. It's the Martian archaeologist thought experiment. Yes. Imagine an exo-archaeologist from another planet is coming to study the physical remains of human civilizations long after humanity is gone. Who knows what we did? We screwed up somehow, and there are none of us around here anymore, but the physical remains of our cities and institutions are still hanging about the Earth.
I've seen enough episodes of Outer Limits to make a few guesses as to how it could have happened.
Right, yeah. The neutron bombs of the Facebook wars, they did the job. Or, hey, maybe there's a better option. Maybe we warped ourselves into the 17th dimension and escaped this world, you know. Not a bad end. So this alien archaeologist is trying to understand lost cultures of humankind through the works of art that they created and preserved. And at some point, she ends up browsing museums. Maybe she's walking through the Louvre and looking at the paintings that were once housed and revered here. And if she were to look over many of the famous paintings of medieval and Renaissance Europe, she might arrive at a question that would be weird to us, but I think perfectly reasonable to her. And that would be, why did so many of the people considered holy by these artists wear wide-brimmed gold hats or gold wires around their heads? Now, of course, with enough cultural context, we ourselves know that these are not hats in the paintings. They're not even supposed to represent real physical objects. This, of course, is the artistic convention known today as the halo. But I think it's interesting that in a lot of these paintings, there might not be anything in the painting that would tell you that in isolation. It just looks like people have something that's yellow or gold, often circular, sometimes square-shaped, or just like a cloud or a kind of glow or radiance around their head.
Yeah, as we'll discuss, it ranges from something that is very subtle to sometimes things that are very unavoidable, even where it goes beyond the halo and becomes this all-encompassing nimbus. But But, you know, you mentioned earlier how the alien might look and say, why are these people considered holy? Why do they have the halo? But I think it would go even beyond that. Like, why do these other organisms that are represented in these works of art, why do they have, like, they wouldn't know they're holy necessarily, you know?
That's true.
They're the subject of a painting. But otherwise, you know, what they might not even be able to piece together what this signifies, what it means. Why is it there, you know?
Why was it that some of these humans, but not others, appeared to have bioluminescence? Like, why does their hair emit light? You know, did they have like chemiluminescence in the keratin of their hair cells or something? And then I think the exoarchaeologists might notice something that a lot of us don't tend to notice when we grow up looking at images of like Jesus and saints and stuff with halos. And that would be the similarity of the iconography here, the glow or the gold circle or disc around the heads of saints and gods in a Christian context, the similarity of that to depictions of gods from other religions, religions that still exist in the world today or the religions of ages past.
Absolutely. You can easily start looking at these halos and things like halos, and you could just go crazy with a conspiracy theory connection board, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's easy to do even if you're not prone to conspiracy thinking. You could think like, oh, well, clearly they're all describing the same thing, either the same mysterious light source that it is forbidden to represent in art that is always positioned directly behind a person, or the same like alien discs that we're interacting with ancient peoples, or you know, you could also go and use it to prop up various theories, such as say the, you know, the bicameral mind hypothesis, things like
right.
that, you know, which I think actually will probably come to people's minds a lot as we roll through this episode in particular.
Oh yeah, there will be some very specific and interesting connections there. But anyway, so to come back to the idea of, you know, what we do know about the halo, the fact that it's an artistic convention. This is one of these subjects that I really love because it's something that I've seen and just taken for granted my entire life without ever mm-hmm. stopping to wonder where it comes from, what it means, and how it connects to history and religion and science. So for the next couple of episodes, we wanted to take a look at the halo from a bunch of different angles and see what kind of sense we can make of it. Now, that opening question I asked of imagining an alien archaeologist looking at these depictions in art that weren't supposed to be physical golden hats but could have been mistaken for such, this actually connects to an episode of The Artifact that I did back in January about ancient Egyptian head cones. If you want to get the full story, you can go and listen to that episode, but the short and simplified version goes like this. A lot of ancient Egyptian art shows people with these weird white cones on top of their heads, you know, maybe about the size of a softball, but cone-shaped. And there has long been a debate about what these cones were supposed to represent. One popular theory is that this is a depiction of a real thing from ancient Egypt, which would have been lumps of unguent or perfumed animal fat, which would melt into the scalp and then perform a kind of ritual purification as the oils came down over your head. It'd be somewhat analogous to the kind of anointing with oil rituals that we see in other ancient Near Eastern traditions that you can even find in the Bible. But because until recently these cones had only been seen in art and never explicitly given physical grounding, there was always some reason to wonder, well, were these cones maybe not physical objects at all, but symbolic artistic conventions like halos? Well, a few years back, some physical examples of head cones were actually found in some graves in Egypt. So we now know that at least some of them were physical objects, though a lot of questions still remain about these head cones. But the analogy to halos really got the gears turning in my brain and got me wondering about halos themselves.
Yeah, it's ultimately a fascinating subject. Again, I'm in the same boat. Like, I grew up seeing all these images of halos to the point where halos didn't even feel suitably weird or even majestic. And I think part of that comes from angel costumes and cartoon depictions of angel costumes, where even someone like Tom and Jerry will have some sort of a halo above their head made out of maybe like foiled cardboard, and it is visibly held in place by some sort of wire that goes down to the back of their neck. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, exactly. Yeah. The domestication of this imagery really kind of takes the awe-inspiring element out of it.
yeah, it ends up making it look kind of stupid, you know? I think you also see some of that in the actual tradition of the halo, with it sort of eventually falling out of favor, except in places where it was really firmly established. But of course, like we said already, you'll see so many different versions of the halo, even in Western art depicting Christian saints and important holy individuals. The one that I ran across that I really liked was Caravaggio's The Madonna di Loreto, or at least a detail from that. And it's such a faint halo. You could easily miss it, perhaps. But it also really stands out at you because the lines in it run counter to the vertical lines behind her.
Yeah, and I like that in Caravaggio's art because it suggests that, in a way, holiness is something that is subtle to the human imagination. Maybe mm-hmm. it would be obvious to the heavens, but, you know, here on Earth, it's just the faintest glimmer of a circle.
Yeah,
you have to look for it.
Yeah, R. Scott Baker, in some of his fantasy books, they're particularly magical individuals who occasionally develop halos around the palms of their hands. And it's not visible all the time, but just at certain moments by certain people. And I feel like that kind of captured some of the energy that you see in illustrations such as this. But other times you see realizations of the halo in art that are just, they look very much like some sort of a physical ring or a physical disc. Like they have one of the golden records that we send into space situated mm-hmm. either right above their head or directly behind it.
Yeah, I've read that this, I think, was especially common among like Florentine artists of the Renaissance who would start depicting the halo almost as if it was a disc in three-dimensional space that was balanced on the back of the head.
Yeah.
One of my favorite saints from art was the subject of some paintings that I saw at the Louvre. It's this guy named Peter of Verona, who is usually mm-hmm. shown with a machete sticking out of his head.
Oh, he yeah. sure is, with blood and everything.
Yeah, blood. And I feel like these paintings of Peter of Verona should be the new This Is Fine meme, because he really looks like, we're making it work. Peter was a 13th century inquisitor, I think. He was some kind of heresy hunter. I think he preached against the Cathars. Mm-hmm. And the story goes that the Cathars hired an assassin to kill him. And then he got hit in the head with a blade of some kind. Like this guy brained him with an axe. And then I think according to the story, he wrote out the Apostles' Creed or part of the Apostles' Creed in his own blood as he was dying.
He also, in both of these, has the images that you shared with me, he also has a blade piercing his heart. It looks like he was front stabbed in one of them and back stabbed in the other depiction.
Yeah.
So ultimately, the jump between this and full-blown Clive Barker Cenobite is not that far.
Man, yes. He's very close to a Cenobite, the machete-head Cenobite.
Mm-hmm. Serene face and all. I mean, really, yeah, the sign between, I mean, there's probably a direct line to be made between his vision of the Cenobites and the depictions of saints suffering, but yet not suffering unholy tortures.
What's medieval Latin for save your tears? It's a waste of good suffering.
I don't know. I don't have that one. Okay. an easy recall for it for me. Yeah, here, Jeff.
But the funny thing is about with Peter, in both of these, he's got like a machete or a butcher knife stuck in his head, like, you know, like the lightning bolt or the arrow party gag headset, mm-hmm. Just sticking out at the top of his head. And you're so fixated on the weapon, you don't even notice that he's got a faint circle around his head or behind it.
Yeah, yeah, there it is, the halo. And you know, I think it's helpful, too, to think about, to ask yourself, like, what could it be? What is this thing behind the head? You know, the physical plate, a glow, an aura. But also you see various interpretations where you can think of it as the sun itself or the moon, some sort of cosmic entity, or perhaps a window, a portal to another realm. Like all of these things you see arise at different times in interpretations of the halo and things that inspired the halo or seem to have inspired it or just have some just basic connection to it based on similar symbology.
Yeah, since there are so many variations on the halo and the related concept of the aureole, I think that it's best to think about the halo not as something that has like strict criteria for what counts as a halo, but more a collection of family resemblances, kind of like the mm-hmm. definition of a game in the Wittgensteinian sense.
Yes.
You know, it's just like there are a lot of things that you can tell they're all related in some way, but there's no set of criteria that all of them meet. But I think we can at least generally say that a halo is something like an area of light or golden color or some kind of radiant cloud, usually circular but not always, surrounding the head of a holy or revered figure. It's also sometimes called a nimbus. I think we've mentioned that already, but it is related to and with significant overlap on the concept of an aureole, which is a glow or area of brightness that surrounds a person, especially their head. So I think there's some looseness with the language here, but as best I can tell, a halo usually refers to the disc or ring or light around the head specifically, and the aureole would include halos, but would also include something like the full body being surrounded by a glow or a golden shine or fire.
Yeah, and that's A-U-R-E-O-L-E, aureole, not yeah. Oreo. Though, in an artistic depiction, you could have an Oreo aureole. It's entirely possible. It's the right shape.
Oh, you certainly could. Oh, have you ever noticed that sometimes products in TV commercials and in advertisements are given a kind of aureole, like a box of cereal will be lit as if there's a light bulb right behind it, so there's a glow yeah. emanating from all the sides?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's one of the reasons I started thinking about, you know, what are some of these paintings we see in these images where it looks like there is a light behind the head. You know, mm-hmm. you can easily imagine panning to one side and there is a tripod back there and there's the photographer's light, you know, and then ultimately right. that's what we do to backlit things today. But yeah, you see things that are like halos and sometimes things that are very much like halos in modern photography. And a lot of it is just by virtue of that sort of positioning we're talking about, either a light position behind the individual just by happenstance because the light's got to go somewhere, or it's some sort of pre-existing symbol or decoration. And I want to draw a specific example here that I've been kind of obsessed with the last couple of months. In fact, since the most recent presidential election, you will see photographs of the U.S. president or presidential candidates, president-elect, etc., in which the presidential seal is positioned directly behind the individual's head, sometimes in sharper focus, but other times blurred a bit just by virtue of being behind them, in a way that looks a lot like halo iconography.
Oh, yeah. So I did not know about this before you brought it up, but now that you have mentioned it, or since I read that you were writing about this, I was seeing it all over the place. Yeah, so you can see George W. Bush with a halo, Barack Obama with a halo. It just seems like there's often enough a big circular seal behind their head when they're getting photographed that these things just naturally happen.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's because you generally have a backdrop back there, and then that's where the presidential seal is, and the presidential seal is circular. And yeah, it ends up looking like a halo. And I was thinking about this. I'm like, well, this is interesting, but I'm sure some people do not like it.
Oh,
and sure enough, I found a wonderful Associated Press blog post about it from 2015, and this was from Paul Coford, the AP's former vice president of media relations. And he points out that the so-called halo issue has been around for a while, and that no matter who happens to be president at a given time, people complain about it. You know, they can make the charge like, what are you doing? You're taking pictures of this president who I don't like, mm-hmm. and you're making them look like they are anointed by God. Like, clearly you have an agenda here in the way that the presidential seal is positioned behind their skull.
Well, I would say whether I like the president or not, if I thought the photographer was doing that on purpose, I wouldn't like it. I mean,
Right, right, yes.
But knowing a bit about photography and perspective, I can actually see why this might be something that's difficult to avoid.
Yeah, Coleford drives home that it's never the intention of a photographer to give the president a holy glow. And according to J. David Akey, AP Washington's then assistant chief of the Bureau for Photography, quote, "The out-of-focus presidential seal is simply a tool to separate the subject from the background so he is not speaking in a sea of black." And then he adds that they try to make it clear that it's the seal and it's not some sort of glowing blur. And they've tried different things. They've tried shooting a lot closer, you know, getting like cropping in tighter to the individual's face so nothing is seen around the head. But then if you do that, well, first of all, you just have like a real close, tight shot yeah. of somebody's face and you can see the president's pores, right?
Yeah.
but then also, more to the point, you lose any sense of context or sense of location. And that's one of the things you're supposed to do as a photographer, is to provide that context and sense of location. And then if you do the reverse, like you pan out more and you try and move that seal around in the background, well, then you risk creating a photo that's not suitable for many uses, such as mobile use. You know, you don't want to be, you know, pull up your news app and you're flipping through it and then you're like, who's that? I don't know. There's some white-haired dude there in the background. Oh, it's the president. I had to zoom in like 300% to see it.
I think the real solution is that presidents just should not have the presidential seal behind them and instead should have like a big, like psychedelic tableau, you know, like the like the cover of the Jimi Hendrix Axis Bold as Love album.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, basically, one of the things it comes down to is this is a shot. This is a photograph that gets taken a lot every time the president gives an address or what have you. And the typical background just doesn't really give photographers much to work with. And photographers are constantly trying to figure out how to frame things up in a way that is visually appealing. So at least for now, until they shake things up and get that new mural background you're talking about, the presidential halo is largely unavoidable. Like, you can play around with it yourself. Put yourself in the photographer's shoes and try to imagine what your options are there. Like, ultimately, the halo is kind of the best way to go.
Well, maybe we can help you out with that today just by helping you as the viewer reframe your thinking about the halo so that it is not only the projection of a Christian saint, but in fact is an older and more widespread tradition of showing the radiance around the head or body of an interesting or important figure throughout world mythology.
Yeah. But I will say that once you start looking for the halo and identifying the halo, you will see it more and more places. So certainly, listeners, as you encounter photographs of people with unintended halos or even intended halos just by virtue of their environment, send those to us. Share those with us. Go to the discussion module, the Stuff to Blow Your Mind discussion module. That's the Facebook group. Share them there. I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, bring them on.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elia Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow, thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Now, one thing we've already touched on is that not all halos or aureoles are circular in nature, but an awful lot of them are. There's a reason that you could mistake a lot of halos in paintings for being, you know, disc-shaped gold hats. So maybe we should probe the circular element here for a minute.
Yeah. The halo in its most traditional form is, of course, going to be either a pair of concentric circles. It's going to be a disc, or it's just going to be a circle or a hoop of some sort. Part of this is we've always been fascinated by circles because the circle is the shape of the sun. It's the shape of the moon. It's the shape of the pupil in our eyeballs. You know, it's just an irresistible. It's a line that goes on forever. I mean, you can go on and on. Like, the circle is fascinating in the same way that the triangle and the square are fascinating. We'll never stop, finding wonder in these shapes.
Yeah, and the fact that there are no perfect circles in nature, but so much of the physical and biological world ends up imperfectly approximating circles and spheres. Mm-hmm. And then it gets even more mysterious and gets into like mathematical mysticism once you have consciousness of geometry, because there you get all kinds of ideas. You know, I think the circle has special mystical allure because of its special status among two-dimensional shapes. It has this relationship to the strange mathematical constant pi, and the fact that if you try to think about it as a polygon, I guess maybe it's technically not a polygon, but if you were to try to frame it as one, it would have to be a polygon with like an infinite number of sides.
But the sun, I think, is of particular note here, not only because of its circular shape and sort of its all-consuming place in human myth-making, but also because of what we call solar halos, and that's something we'll get into more in the second episode. But there are recordings of depictions of solar halos dating back to antiquity. In particular, the eruption of Mount Etna in 122 and 44 BCE resulted in rainbow-like halos that were observed at that time. I was reading Ancient Meteorological Optics by Richard Stothers in the Classical Journal from 2009, and he goes into this and includes a list of such observations from roughly 203 BCE on up till 351 CE, in addition to mock suns, which is another optical phenomenon we'll discuss in the next episode, and these have been recorded from as far back as 525 BC in Egypt, up through Roman observations in 193 CE.
So the observation of light-based disks and rings in space and in the sky, I think, could naturally suggest some associations between those types of shapes or figures and holiness because of the longstanding religious associations with celestial objects, space, and the sky.
Right. And then on top of that, too, you start thinking about just symbol making and the creation of lines, the etching of lines into things. And as you begin to juggle different symbols and combining symbols, it's inevitable that you would combine the human form with the circle, with the sun disk, etc.
All right. So we've already mentioned that the halo is a very common piece of religious symbolism in Christian art, especially in like the medieval through the Renaissance period. So how exactly does that happen? How does the halo become a part of how Christians depict their God and their saints?
So these only pop up in Christian religious art after the 5th century CE. And before that, it was used to highlight, literally highlight, right, important secular people such as kings and emperors.
Yeah, there is a long tradition going back before Christianity in the Greco-Roman world of showing like kings and emperors, I think especially when associated with Apollo or Helios, gods that are gods of the sun or associated with the sun, to show these figures with rays of light emanating from their heads, which are very similar to, or in some cases, basically the same as a halo. Yeah. And so you could get a pagan emperor with a halo before any depictions of, say, Jesus with a halo.
Yeah, exactly. And as pointed out by Derek Kudzi, citing Tavino Perry and Ramsden, I'll discuss them in a minute, in The Impact of the Symbolism and Iconography of the Ankh, Sun Disk, and Wadjet Eye on Modern Western Society, saints and other religious figures at this time were just shown as normal humans. Meanwhile, yes, the secular rulers, they were the ones with the halos.
So that's funny. You got to imagine, like, how would that be reversed? Like if Christians in, say, the second century in the Roman Empire were seeing depictions of the perhaps hated Roman emperor with a halo, how would they end up putting that same kind of imagery on Jesus?
Yeah, exactly. So it's really fascinating to turn that on its head here, at least for, like I say, modern consideration of the past. So that Tavernor Perry paper. That's J. Tavernor Perry. It was a 1907 paper titled "The Nimbus in Eastern Art." And despite being a 1907 publication, you can pull this up in JSTOR, and it's a short, very succinct little piece with some wonderful illustrations. And you know, this points out, and also Kutzi was commenting on this, is that while there's certainly an urge to connect halos in the Western tradition to the ancient Egyptian use of the sun disk, they conclude that although the halo came from the ancient Near East, it seems to stem from Mesopotamian and Persian use that had been appropriated by the Greeks and then later by the Byzantines.
Okay, so if this tracing of the history is correct, it's saying that there are analogies to the halo in ancient Egyptian iconography, but it looks like the Christians got their use from the Greeks and Romans, who in turn got the halo ideas from the ancient cultures that would have occupied present day, like Iraq and Iran.
Right. Yeah. So the idea is, yeah, the Roman usage of it would have been like, hey, we really like this motif. Let's use it. Let's use it to signify our rulers. Mm-hmm. And then eventually it passes on to Christian use. I mean, it's kind of a story of just how irresistible an alarming or captivating image is, or a combination of symbols happens to be. Now, that other piece, E.H. Ramsden, this is a much longer piece. It's a lengthy notice in the same publication, Burlington Magazine, from 1941, titled "The Halo, A Further Inquiry into Its Origin." And this one points to the influence of Zoroastrianism on Christianity in general, which would bring with it the Kavarna, or the Havarna, which the author here describes as, quote, "the great Havarno, the main symbol of royal power, an age-old motif of Iranian art." And so Ramsden draws a connection between these artistic motifs and what was to come in both Christian and Buddhist traditions.
Ah, okay.
So it's literally a glory or splendor indicating a divine force guiding the individual. Also kind of sometimes seen as sort of, like divine goodwill. It's a kind of holy spotlight reserved for kings and leaders. And I guess that's something to keep in mind, too, when we're thinking about this. You think about the role of the divine king in older traditions. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like that's the individual who, you know, the whole system is describing as being the chosen one of God or the gods, etc.
Yeah, and so at least for me, it's not hard to see how halo imagery would have been more thoroughly integrated into Christian artwork in a period after Christianity was made socially acceptable in a widespread way in the Roman Empire, say under Constantine, and then eventually became the official religion of the Roman Empire. There you would see a unification of Christianity with the state power in the Roman Empire.
Yeah, yeah. So it's interesting to think about what the halo does, especially in later art, about how it signifies that the individual you're looking at is indeed holy. It's weird when you look at the quality of the art, or I guess maybe not the quality of the art, but the changing detail of the art, the changing lifelike qualities of the art over time, because it would it would seem to me, as someone who's not an expert in these things, that once you get into the age of Caravaggio, you know, you don't need the halo to show, you know, divine suffering in an individual. You don't need that halo to realize that the individual in the painting is divine. Like, there are all these other tools, all these other levers you can pull to make it so. And yet they're still there. Mm-hmm. I was reading this wonderful piece, very well written, by Emilia Arenas, titled Sex, Violence, and Faith, The Art of Caravaggio. And they point out that the halo, along with other symbolic inclusions, were often the only way to recognize any given individual in a painting before Caravaggio and the traditions before him, that this was a particular saint, et cetera. They'd be like, oh, well, there's the halo, or there's the, you know, they're holding, you know, a particular object or some sort of a grisly sign of their passing, that sort of thing.
Right, because these saints wouldn't have been somebody, you know, it wasn't like they had People magazine where you know what the famous figures looked like. You know, there were no photographs, and you probably never would have seen these people. So there wasn't like one way that a figure looked. You would have to use cues in the painting itself to identify who they were, or to identify which of the figures in the painting was the person.
Right. And Arenas writes that in the older tradition, you know, a lot of these people with the halos or other symbols, they were basically interchangeable looking because they just looked like other rich people of the time.
Yeah.
And then by the time Caravaggio is coming along, he's making them look more and more like actual people. And this is interesting too, though, because you hear about the sort of behind the scenes stuff on various famous paintings, and you learn that, oh, well, this person that's portraying Jesus or whoever, that was just some strapping lad from somewhere around town that mm-hmm. came in to pose for some paintings.
Right.
So they're still, you know, not actual depictions of you know, are supposed to, you know, be actual depictions of the person. You know, it's not a snapshot of an historic Jesus or anything, but it's somebody that's put there, and then you add these other things, these other symbols that allow you to gain something from it. And I think that gets into the role, the longstanding role of religious art that you see not only in Christianity, but in Hinduism, Buddhism, etc. And that is the use of the image to convey often complex theological ideas mm-hmm. that you know, that may even be difficult to explain with language. Things such as the transfiguration of Christ and the various complex roles and powers of Hindu deities and also meditative practices in Tibetan Buddhism. You know, these are all things that are often, you know, laboriously baked into the visual image that you're presented with, even if you're an outsider, you don't necessarily pick up on all of these things.
I think a lot of times one thing that religious painting tends to do is to inject a kind of visceral passion into stories that are actually told just in pure linguistic terms in a kind of spare way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, reading the text of the crucifixion narrative in the Gospel of Mark is going to ask you to sort of do a lot of work of, like, reading, you know, passionate imagery into it. It's actually a rather lean narrative, but you can do a painting of it that's mm-hmm. just full of pathos and anguish and showing the full suffering that the artist wanted to depict.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, I guess it's time to get into some interesting examples of other religious and artistic traditions around the world that show something that might be considered analogous to the halo or aureole outside of the Christian artistic tradition. One of the oldest analogs to the image of the halo that I came across might be something that is found in ancient Mesopotamian mythology. So I want to start off with a specific example from the many stories of Gilgamesh. Now, in the Gilgamesh narratives, there is a recurring theme where Gilgamesh and his friend or his servant Enkidu have to travel to the dreaded cedar forest to slay a monstrous giant called Huwawa or Humbaba, who is the terrifying guardian of the woods, whose roar is as a flood, whose mouth is fire, and whose breath is death itself. One version of the story I was looking at included a line that was something like, Huwawa, like a man-eating lion, he does not wipe the blood from his slaver.
Now, in that. Some interpretations of this, right, Enkidu is kind of a beast man himself, right?
Yes, I think so. Now, I'm not an expert in this. I think in the actual Epic of Gilgamesh, which is a later sort of built out version of this recurring motif, he is.
He's kind of a wild man, at least, if not a beast man.
Oh, yeah. He's on the locusts and honey diet. But anyway, there are tons of different versions of this story from ancient Mesopotamian poetry and mythology where Gilgamesh or Gilgamesh and Enkidu have to go kill this monster in the cedar forest. And in many versions of the story found in different ancient texts, Huwawa or Humbaba is said to be surrounded by seven layers of something. Sometimes this something is interpreted as more straightforwardly a type of cloak or armor that protects him. So he's got seven layers of armor, seven cloaks. Other times it is interpreted as Humbaba's seven terrors or even his seven auras that inflict a horror, a supernatural terror on his enemies. And in one Sumerian version of the early story, Gilgamesh and Huwawa, it says that when the warriors neared Huwawa, the monster's aura sped towards them like a spear.
Oh, wow. So they're like, it's like he's got seven shield tokens that not only protect him, but can be used offensively as well.
Wait, what are the shield tokens?
Oh, I just, you know, in various board games, you would have tokens for your shield.
Okay.
So it's like seven shields. So like you'd have to combat your way through all seven shields before you could actually hurt the creature itself.
Yes, it's clear they have some kind of defensive effect. They also have some kind of offensive effect. And it's very ambiguous exactly what they are. They're a thing that can be taken on and off, and they protect him. And they are an emanation of supernatural power that is sometimes represented as a kind of light or glow. And in many versions of the story, what happens is Gilgamesh entices Huwawa to take off and hand over his seven terrors or his seven auras one at a time by offering gifts and flattery in return. So Gilgamesh will come up to him and he'll go to Huwawa and say, "No one knows where you live in the mountains. I want to be like you. I want to be one of your kinsmen. Here is a gift of lapis lazuli. Hand over your fifth aura." And so then Huwawa hands over his, you know, each of one of his seven auras in succession. At some point, Gilgamesh offers one of his sisters to Huwawa as a concubine. At some point, he offers him, I think, some kind of special flower or grain. But eventually, once all of the auras or terrors are removed, Gilgamesh can suddenly beat the monster up. Like in some versions, it says immediately Gilgamesh punches him in the face. And I was reading about there's one specific version of this story that involves a great debate about whether to chase after the auras. It seems like the auras like fly off on their own. I was reading about this in the Epic of Gilgamesh, the Babylonian Epic Poem, and other texts in Akkadian and Sumerian by Andrew George from Penguin in 2002. And this example is in what's known as the Iskali tablet. It's a tablet that contains one version of the story, supposedly dated to the 18th century BCE. And so in this version of the story, Enkidu and Gilgamesh, after Huwawa is defeated, Enkidu says to Gilgamesh, "Hey, don't spare your foe." But Gilgamesh wants to go hunt down Huwawa's auras, like they've somehow gotten away. And the text here describes them as radiant, numinous powers that Huwawa wears as protection. And Gilgamesh is like, "No, we got to go get him." And Enkidu suggests that they can easily do that later. Instead, we've got to stay here and kill Huwawa. And then after we kill Huwawa, we can go find the auras. And to quote from the tablet in translation, said Enkidu to him, "To Gilgamesh, smite Huwawa, the ogre who your gods abhor. Why, my friend, do you show him mercy?" Said Gilgamesh to him, to Enkidu, "Now, my friend, we must impose our victory. The auras slip away in the thicket. The auras slip away. Their radiance grows dim." Said Enkidu to him, to Gilgamesh, "My friend, catch a bird, and where go its chicks? Let us look for the auras later as the chicks run here and there in the thicket."
Yeah, I love that. I mean, it almost takes on a comical air for sure.
Yeah.
But it also reminds me, just thinking about, I mean, I love the idea of thinking about these as sort of as haunted auras that surround him and energy fields, et cetera. But of course, I'm going back to our episode. I think it was the Horned Helm episode that we talked about mm-hmm. the invention of a little bit about the inventions of armor and helmets. And we talked about how the cloak itself is an important piece of armor in many older traditions. You know, it was a basic way to protect your body in combat. So perhaps these are just like many different living animate cloaks that he wore. And isn't it interesting that even today we have imagined beings with animate cloaks? Like I know, for example, I think Doctor Strange has a living cloak that has a mind of its own. And I want to say that Spawn does as well. I'm not an expert on Spawn, but I think there's something about his cloak being alive as well.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, Spawn's got a cape or something. It's like a big, in the movie, it's this giant CGI cape that does magic stuff.
Yeah.
But so here, I guess the idea is that this monster had the seven, whatever these are, the auras, the terrors, the seven sort of defensive, magical, glowing, full body halo type things, and that he can take them off and put them back on. And when he takes them off, after he's defeated, they all scatter all over the place. And you have to go catch them if you want to, domesticate his halos and put them to your own uses. So I was reading further about this concept of these ancient Mesopotamian auras or halo type things in a book called Gods, Demons, and Symbols by Jeremy Black and Anthony Green from the University of Texas Press in 1992. And they're also talking about the story of Huwawa or Humbaba, and they translate the word for the seven layers as terrifying radiance. And they relate this to a broader entry they've got on a couple of concepts from ancient Mesopotamian religion called Melam and Ni. These are both Sumerian words. Melam's Akkadian equivalent is Melamu. And Melam refers to a specific type of divine power, while Ni seems to refer to the effect that Melam has upon humans. So if you are walking through the cedar forest and you hear a rustling in the bushes and then Huwawa pops out and you witness his Melam, you will probably be stricken with Ni. And no, I do not know if there is any connection to the Monty Python thing, but I kind of wonder.
Yeah, the knights that say knee.
Yeah. But Black and Green write, quote, "The exact connotation of Melam is difficult to grasp. It is a brilliant, visible glamour which is exuded by gods, heroes, sometimes by kings, and also by temples of great holiness and by gods' symbols and emblems. While it is in some ways a phenomenon of light, Melam is at the same time terrifying, awe-inspiring. Ni can be experienced as a physical creeping of the flesh." And they say that both Sumerian and Akkadian are rich in words to describe this phenomenon and its effects. So in keeping with the story we were looking at a minute ago, they say that gods are sometimes said to wear their melam like a garment or like a crown. And they say that like a garment or a crown, the melam can be taken off. You can shed it. And if you kill a god, its melam will vanish or run away. They also stress that while the Melam is apparently always supernatural, it is not inherently good. Both revered gods and monstrous demons wear the Melam alike. It seems to be a visual representation of overwhelming supernatural power that is imagined as some kind of emanation of light or glow.
Fascinating. So a holy or unholy aura.
Yeah, and this is one of those things that I just feel like, oh, I wish I could know, like, where does this concept come from? Like, does this have some kind of basis in the natural world, or is this pure imagination? Or does it have some basis in, I don't know, quirks of human psychology? I mean, I guess we'll get more into sort of natural phenomena and psychology in the second episode, but man, yeah, this gets the gears going, like I said earlier.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I love that. Even, you know, the mystery even makes these tales resonate even more so. Like if it were more clear that we were just talking about a bunch of cloaks, mm-hmm. you know, or just basic cloak metaphors, then it wouldn't be as magical.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Now, from here, let's travel over to ancient Egypt, because we mentioned earlier the idea of sun disks. And there are several directions to go in when considering the sun disk in ancient Egypt. But the one that probably comes to mind most readily, of course, is the state worship of the sun disk Aten under Amenhotep IV. This was he decreed that, okay, we're going to put the pantheon more or less aside, or we're gonna instead of focusing on the pantheon or certain individuals in the pantheon of gods, we're just going to worship this glorious sun disk Aten. And we could do a whole episode on this because it's such a fascinating story. But basically, this was an unpopular move that was reversed after his death. You know, it's tough to introduce a new god and a new twist on religion and expect everyone else to just stay with that change.
Yeah. Now, I know there are some people who claim here that Amenhotep is in some ways like the inventor of monotheism. I think that might be a little bit oversimplifying the issue. Mm-hmm. It seems, from what I recall, I haven't studied this deeply in a while, but it seems like from what I recall, the Aten sun disk that he was revering was sort of like already a figure in Egyptian religion, but now he said like, well, this is now just the only god that we're going to worship, and the other ones are all subordinate to that god.
Yeah, yeah, this is basically my understanding as well. Yeah, there's if you're saying that he converted the Egyptians to monotheism, that's exaggerating a bit, but certainly the sun disk in general pops up in various places throughout Egyptian iconography and oftentimes looks similar to what we might think of as a halo today. So just to run through a few key examples that I think illustrate this well. First of all, there's Nut, the sky goddess, who's sometimes rendered as a giant nude woman arched above the earth. You can look up images of this. It's where, you know, it's like she's kind of in cat-cow, I guess, yoga-wise, but she is the vaulted sky above.
Oh, I don't know that yoga pose. Tell me.
Oh, it's, you're on all fours and you're kind of like, you're either like a cat or you're like a cow.
Okay.
You should try it. It's great for the spine.
Okay.
But yeah, she's kind of in that position and her arched body is the cosmos. Like you're looking up at her belly when you're looking up at the stars. But sometimes she's represented as a giant cow with star markings and a sun disk positioned between the cow's horns. Again, oh. She's associated with the sky. And this also signifies, according to Geraldine Pinch in Egyptian mythology, this signifies her as the sky god lifting up the sun god Ray or Ra. And she mentions that this, quote, becomes the insignia of several goddesses. So Re or Ra, the sun god himself, is depicted in various ways as well, including a sun disk with a scarab on it or in it. But you also see him depicted as, in his hybrid form with the sun disk above his head or on top of his head. Now, to be clear, you see this with other deities and characters in the Egyptian pantheon as well. The symbol of their role or identity is simply stacked atop their head like a hat, like a scorpion is up on your head to signify, that your scorpion-like qualities, etc. So again, think about the necessity of delivering information through symbols. There are only so many ways to present the idea of man plus sun equals sun god, right? And it's just here's a man, or here's a hybrid of a man, and then here's a sun, and they are the sun god.
When you were talking about the goddess Nut with the representation as the cow with the sun disk above the head, I was trying to think, is this the same as the imagery I've already seen, or is there another ancient Egyptian deity or figure often depicted as a bovine with a halo or sun disk over its head? And I think the thing I was thinking about was the Apis bull, which is, I think, somewhat different. So there's another one. Apparently, ancient Egyptian religion has multiple bulls with halos. I mean, in the loose sense of halo, a bull with the sun disk between its horns.
Well, I actually have the answer to that, and that is because Apis is the offspring of another Egyptian goddess, and that is Hathor. And she's the golden goddess of childbirth, and she's often depicted as a beautiful woman with a red solar disk positioned above her head between a pair of cow horns. And she's associated with Ra and Re as well. I think it's kind of complex and like it varies. Like sometimes she's more like the offspring and other times she's more like a consort, et cetera. Or it seemed a little ambiguous when I was reading about it. But the Apis bull is the offspring of Hathor. Hathor is tied to the sun god. So it's like the sun disk is there to show that they are aligned or descended from him.
Now, if the scholars that you were looking at earlier, if their theory about the history of the halo iconography that led to Christian religion is true, even though it would sort of make sense to look at the Apis bull or any of these gods you've been talking about with a sun disk over their head and say, ah, that inspired the Christian halo symbol, it seems like at least they were arguing that's not the case, which if they're correct about that, that would just make it seem like almost a case of cultural convergent evolution, right? Something that just so naturally comes to mind that multiple different cultures have produced very similar imagery.
Yeah. Now, I mean, part of it could be I just haven't come across and read an argument to the contrary. But mm-hmm. yeah, it seems like it's just a situation of different peoples playing with some of the same symbols and doing the obvious things with those symbols. Because while it might seem like this would be a great connection, like it seems like you could put Hathor on your conspiracy board and then put the Archangel Michael on your conspiracy board and just draw a line between the two, mm-hmm. it does not seem as if there's actually a line to be drawn there, you know, in the actual spread of symbolism and, you know, artistic motifs.
It might actually go back more to Humbaba or Huwawa, right?
Yeah.
Or just generally the Mesopotamian concept. But I've got another one from the pre-Christian ancient world with some interesting similarities to halo iconography. And this would be the Achaean halo. Could you believe that there is something like a halo in the Iliad?
This got me by surprise as well, yeah.
Yeah, I guess a lot of people have read this and not necessarily noticed the similarities. Again, you know, there are always going to be some differences, but the similarities are interesting. So there's one passage in Book 18 of the Iliad that strikes me as very, very pretty darn halo-ish. So it comes in Book 18 of the Iliad. The context is that the great Achaean warrior, Achilles, he learns that his beloved companion, Patroclus, has been killed in battle by the Trojan hero, Hector. And the exact relationship between Achilles and Patroclus has been the subject of enormous debate over the centuries. At the very least, they are supposed to be the closest of friends. You know, they're brothers in arms, they're confidants. Some scholars also believe there's an implication that they're lovers. That's not stated explicitly, but some really think it's sort of there subtly in the text. Whatever the exact nature of their relationship, they care very deeply for one another. And Patroclus is killed in battle. And when Achilles learns that Patroclus has died, he almost literally goes insane with grief. And then that grief turns into rage and a thirst for vengeance. And the Trojans and the Achaeans are in the middle of fighting to claim Patroclus's body from the battlefield. So the goddess Athena intervenes, and she pours her god power into Achilles so that he can become so frightening that the Trojans will flee in terror, and Patroclus's body can be brought back behind the Achaean lines. And the way this is visually depicted is very interesting. So I want to read from from the recent translation of the Iliad by Caroline Alexander, which is very good. Rachel and I started reading this. We haven't made it all the way through yet, but we started reading this and I really like it. So if you're looking to read the Iliad for the first time or the 50th, I recommend this one. But the passage here goes like this. Achilles, beloved of Zeus, arose, and Athena cast the tasseled aegis about his mighty shoulders. She, shining among goddesses, encircled round his head a cloud of gold, and from it blazed bright shining fire. And as when smoke rising from a city reaches the clear high air from a distant land, which enemy men fight round, and they the whole day long are pitted in hateful warfare around their city walls, but with the sun setting, the beacon fires blaze, torch upon torch, and flaring upward, the glare becomes visible to those who live around, in the hope that they might come with ships as allies against destruction. So from Achilles' head, the radiance reached the clear high air. And going away from the wall, he stood at the ditch, nor did he mix with the Achaeans, for he observed his mother's knowing command, and standing there he shouted, and from the distance Pallas Athena cried out too. Unspeakable was the uproar he incited in the Trojans, as when a clarion voice is heard, when cries the trumpet of life-destroying enemies who surround a city. Such then was the clarion voice of Iasides. And when they heard the brazen voice of Iasides, the spirit in each man was thrown in turmoil. The horses with their fine manes wheeled their chariots back, for in their hearts they forebode distress to come, and the charioteers were struck from their senses when they saw the weariless, terrible fire above the head of Peleus's great-hearted son blazing, and this the gleaming-eyed goddess Athena caused to blaze.
That's wonderful. I mean, that's the spotlight of the gods right there. That's the light of Athena shining through Achilles's brain and through his rage.
Yeah, it's amazing. So there's some things in common with the Melam or Melamu, some things in common with what could later be seen in Christian halos. You could say that the radiance here is a phenomenon of light. It's described as blazing like fire, like a beacon of light. It surrounds the head. It is a god power, it's conferred supernaturally, and it strikes terror in the heart of those who behold it.
Wow. Yeah, I absolutely love that. And of course, this especially is one of those examples that you can easily tie into ideas concerning the bicameral mind, you know, the idea that, it, especially in this moment, that Achilles is, you know, completely overcome by this this inspired rage. But one interesting thing here is you would never, no matter how you're looking at Achilles here, you probably would not make the argument that Achilles is in an enlightened state, that he is,
no.
that he's experiencing enlightenment. And yet that is another way that you see halo or halo-like symbols used in other artistic traditions, particularly in Buddhist traditions.
Oh, yeah, because there's a whole class of halo or aureole-type glows that can be found throughout Hindu and Buddhist art.
Yeah, in Tibetan art, for example, a form of a halo is often used to signify enlightenment and or divinity. You'll see it on the Buddha himself, but also on important monks. And I was reading a description of a 12th century Buddha from Kurt Behrendt's Tibet and India Buddhist Traditions and Transformations, 2014, from the Met. Quote, this is just his description of this particular work. Quote, he sits on a lotus, conveying ideas of purity and perhaps suggesting his radiance in a cosmic realm, and his head is encircled by a flaming halo. So Behrendt also describes a Buddha statue that in its original form seems to have possessed a halo that was surrounded by branches in reference to the Bodhi tree under which the Buddha first attained enlightenment.
Yeah, and I feel like, I'm not certain, but I feel like I've seen depictions of the Buddha surrounded by fire.
Yeah, we see this kind of flaming nimbus in Chinese and also in Islamic traditions as well. There's also a really neat one in Japanese traditions that's referred to as the Karura flame. Karura is essentially like a Japanese Garuda, you know, this bird-like, magical, holy creature. But the Karura flame here is often represented as a kind of traditional halo behind the head, this kind of hoop design, but mm-hmm. with portions, at least portions of it, on fire. And I included an image of you here, image of it here for you, Joe, described as the Karura Inko.
Yeah, it's almost like a hoop with a bonfire at each of the cardinal directions on it.
Now, if we broaden our definition from halo to also things that are more like, you know, the aureolas and even mandorla, which is a kind of halo that emanates from or behind the entire body, you know, kind of in keeping with those various auras of the monster we described earlier, of Humbaba. There are plenty more examples as well. We certainly see this in Christian traditions, but it's also widespread throughout the iconography of India, particularly Buddhist images. And in Hinduism, statues are often depicted with a praha mandala placed above the statue, and particularly the head, to indicate hallowed status. And these are often very ornate with animals and decorative designs in them. Sometimes, you know, they're often crafted of shining metal with red paint, and they're signifying the object or being here as something that should be venerated.
Now, in looking at images of the praha mandala, one thing I really like about them, especially compared to a lot of the Christian iconography of the halo, which is often very smooth, it's just kind of a radiance, or it's a smooth-looking, almost gold metal-type disc. The Prabha Mandala is very textured. It's very busy. There's a lot of stuff happening in it. You almost get more of the sense of the complexity and the almost like, I don't know, like teeming ant-like radiance of the complexity of the real world.
Now, another very, I think, a pretty famous rendition of the Praha Mandala that a lot of you have probably seen is when you see statues of the dance of Shiva. There's kind of this this flaming hoop that is around Shiva, and it is it's less it's less intricate as this. Like, it's not a big solid thing. It is more of a hoop. But that's probably one that a lot of you have seen before. And I believe this is typically referred to as a Nataraja.
Yeah, like a big hoop halo surrounding the entire body with the flames all around. It's almost like, I mean, it's coming back in the other sense. So we've talked about the way that objects in the natural world, like the sun, might cause you to want to frame an image of a god as something that's emanating light or has its head surrounded by a glowing or gleaming disk. But it just occurred to me also, I mean, I wonder in what ways could you talk about just the practical necessities of framing the subjects of art as having an influence on these various traditions of halos and aureoles and prabha mandalas and things like that. Because often these things do serve as a frame. They're like a visual focusing tool.
Yeah, certainly. It tells you where to look at, what to focus on.
I'm looking at a dance of Shiva within the Nataraja that it's got a bunch of snakes.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's just so interesting to look at how even within a particular religion or regional tradition, over time you'll see so many different takes on it. Like, artists have just always had to sort of reinvent, in this case, the halo or something like a halo. You know, what can I do that sets it apart, that makes it exciting again, that makes it convey the power, the majesty, the rage, or whatever it is, the enlightenment, whatever you're trying to convey through the imagery, how to keep that present.
That's well put.
Which leads me to Mortal Kombat. There's a it, just in passing, we mentioned fictional characters earlier. There, in the latest rendition, there is a goddess character named Cetrion, and you get to change the way your characters look. And one of the things you can do is you change the various halo-like things emanating around her head. Mm. It's actually quite interesting. Like, is it going to be rocks? Is it going to be jewels? Is it going to be something, nature-like, stick-like and all? But, ultimately, they managed to work a lot of what we're talking about into that particular character design.
Now, in any of those like WWE build a wrestler games, can you build a wrestler with a halo?
I bet you could. I don't remember it specifically, but I bet there was some sort of hokey looking halo that you could put on a character. There's probably been somebody who's wrestled in a goofy angel costume. Now that I say that, though, I bet there's a luchador that has a halo. There are a lot of luchadors that have, Catholic imagery tied up in their masks.
El Santo doesn't have a halo, does he?
Well, not Santo, but there are others. Like, there are other Catholic-themed luchadors, and I bet there's one that I'm just not thinking of that, maybe Mystico or somebody has some sort of halo iconography wrapped up in their design.
That's homework for next time.
Yeah.
Have to come back and report.
So Lucha fans out there, let me know who I'm forgetting.
Okay, well, I think that's got to wrap it up for part one.
Yeah. Well, this has been fun, and it lays the groundwork for the next episode, where we'll inevitably touch on some more cultural examples and cultural ideas of halos, but we'll also get into some of the optics that we teased briefly in this episode. And of course, in the meantime, we'd love to hear from everybody. What are your favorite examples of halo iconography from art history, from archaeological finds, et cetera, from fiction? Are there particularly interesting renditions of halo imagery that you like? I was always partial to Michael William Kaluta's angel drawings. He would do, he had some very bizarre looking angel drawings that he created with like flaming halos and halos of eyes and the like. So I'm sure there's some other great examples out there. So send them our way. In the meantime as well, if you would like to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you can find the Stuff to Blow Your Mind feed wherever you get your podcasts. There you will find core episodes, Science and Culture, on Tuesdays and Thursdays. You'll find listener mails on Mondays. Wednesday, that's the day we bust out our short-form artifact episodes. And Friday, it's Weird House Cinema.
That's right. You got to catch them all. So huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.